from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
There's been a big kidnapping on the West Coast. The victim is Patricia Hearst, the daughter of newspaper executive Randolph Hearst and a granddaughter of the legendary William Randolph Hearst.
Coming up in Forums next hour, New Yorker staff writer and CNN senior legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin has been digging into the notorious case of Patty Hearst, who was taken hostage by members of the Symbionese Liberation Army in Berkeley in 1974. Toobin will join us in studio to talk about his new book, American Heiress, the wild saga of the kidnapping, crimes, and trial of Patty Hearst. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. In 1974, Patty Hearst, the granddaughter of newspaper tycoon William Randolph Hearst, was kidnapped from her Berkeley apartment by a radical political group which came to be known as the Symbionese Liberation Army. And the year and a half that followed Patty Hearst, the hostage became Tanya the Revolutionary, committing crimes on behalf of her supposed captors until her eventual arrest in 1975. New Yorker writer and CNN analyst Jeffrey Toobin covers the bizarre saga in his new book, American Heiress. And we'll talk this hour with Jeffrey Toobin about the Hearst kidnapping, the trial, and the still ongoing debate about the case and her guilt and innocence. And welcome, Jeffrey Toobin.
Michael, great to be back.
Great to have you back here. Before we get into the Patty Hearst case, there's much else I want to talk with you about, particularly since people are tweeting about the OJ Emmy Awards and how you got dissed and you should have been mentioned more and all that. But we'll hear from you on that. But first, I wanted to play a tape recording of Patricia Hearst's voice broadcast by Berkeley radio station KPFA in 1974. The recording was sent to her father, Randolph Hearst, publisher by the Symbionese Liberation Army. You want to set this up for us, Jeff?
Well, I'm not sure which one this is. Is it the original one or which date? Because they're very different tapes.
Let's hear.
Why don't we listen
first,
and I'll explain.
I was very upset, though, to hear about the police rushing in on that house in Oakland. And I was just really glad that I wasn't there. And I would appreciate it if everyone would just calm down and not try to find me and not be making identifications, because they're not only endangering me, but they're endangering themselves. There's no way that I will be released until they let me go. So it wouldn't do any good for somebody to come in here and try to get me out by force. These people aren't just a bunch of nuts. They've been really honest with me that they're perfectly willing to die for what they're doing. And I want to get out of here, but the only way I'm going to is if we do it their way. And I just hope that you'll do what they say, Dad, and just do it quickly.
Okay, I know exactly what that was. You know, that was one of the first tapes that she sent when she was being held in the closet in Daly City. She was kidnapped on February 4th, 1974, and the tape where she announced that she was going to be Tanya and was going to join the SLA was March 31st. So it's about a seven-week period there. And this is about somewhere in the middle, as I recall. And you can sort of hear the transition in her voice there. It is not the original communique that she sent, where she sounds really very deadened and very
manipulated, too.
Right. Yeah. Where here, there's a little bit more of an improvisation in what she's saying. I mean, obviously, she's still in captivity. She's still being told basically what to say. But you can start to hear that she's listening to her captors. And there's that great phrase that these people are not just a bunch of nuts, which is not something she was told to say. I mean, she was basically told to say the general idea, but you can start to see the influence of the SLA. You know, right after she was kidnapped, she celebrated her 20th birthday. She was 19 when she was kidnapped. I mean, it just gives you some idea of how young she was and what an impressionable time she was in.
Well, that's certainly part of what you write about, is that impressionability that she had. And she was living in a situation where she was like an old jaded housewife in many respects. I mean, she was not happy with Stephen Weed, even though they had become engaged at that point. And he was the older man in her life and her teacher and so forth.
Right. He was all of 23. He was an older man, but she was 19. And that's, you know, the SLA knew nothing about her personally, except that she was William Randolph Hearst's granddaughter and that she was a Berkeley student who lived with her boyfriend. But what happened was she was uniquely well situated to be someone who might change in captivity. As you pointed out, she was really sick of Stephen Weed. She didn't like living with him. She was bored. She was frustrated. She was not getting along with her mother either, who was a very conservative woman who was unhappy that her daughter was living in sin, to use the phrase of the day. And so she was kind of whipsawed between these two key relationships in her life. And she was restless and unhappy. And like a lot of people who were 19 years old, she was impressionable. And the SLA, it was a terrifying, awful experience to be kidnapped. But once she was kidnapped, they started talking to her and making their case to her, which ultimately, I believe, she accepted.
Converting her, in effect. That's your argument. We want to get into the whole notion that the media played up on the Stockholm Syndrome and all that. But before we do that, a tweet came in just a minute ago saying, congratulations to Jeffrey Toobin on The Enemy of the People versus O.J. Simpson. Will this book be American Crime Story 2? And it, as I said, you know, you were getting a lot of support from people who felt you should have had a lot more recognition. But
can I say one thing?
Yeah.
This is what it's like to be on KQED. You said The Enemy of the People versus O.J. Simpson. You can't help but quote Ibsen. It wasn't Ibsen. It was the people versus O.J. Simpson. But you were just so highbrow, Michael. You have to try to throw
in. I wasn't even thinking
Ibsen
of Ibsen.
And Ibsen Rebsen. No.
No, that was what the tweet said. I'm just reading mindlessly from the tweet.
But your listeners are so erudite. That's the thing. No, look, it was a total thrill to be part of the experience with my friends at FX. You know, it is true that none of the winners thanked me. And I would say if my life is so full of joy that the worst thing that ever happens to me is I'm not thanked at the Emmys, I think I'm going to have a pretty good life. So I can't really say I'm upset about that.
You've had a pretty good life anyway.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I have no complaints.
Yeah, I want to get back to Patty Hearst, though, because the reason I'm mentioning the O.J. Book is that a lot of people do pair them as two of the great crime stories. And David Weir, our colleague who did a cover story in Rolling Stone with Howard Cohen about Patty Hearst, which you may certainly have come across in your research.
They are not just reporters in the story. They are critical figures. And that Rolling Stone piece was very important in the development of the story, also very important in the development of Rolling Stone as an institution that survives today.
And these stories are very important in terms of the whole what we take for granted now is the media circus. That was really the point I was getting to.
Well, it's funny. People always talk about the Patty Hearst case as sort of the original media circus. And you know the example they give of how crazy much coverage there was. They say, you know, she was on the cover of Newsweek 7 times. And today people will say to you, A, what's Newsweek? And B, what's a cover? So, I mean, it is almost curiously antique, the nature of great press attention. There were 30-minute evening news shows. There was the Today Show. Good Morning America didn't even start until 1975. You know, the O.J. case is almost precisely the midpoint between today and the Patty Hearst case. And that was a moment where cable news really sort of came of age, and it was gavel to gavel on CNN and Court TV. But the media universe during Patty Hearst was so much smaller than it is today that what's striking is not how much attention it got, but how little compared to what it might get today.
Well, I was struck by many things in your book, and it really does read like a mystery novel, and you get into some extraordinary detail, really. I mean, it shocked people to read about what rents used to go for here in the Bay Area back then in the 70s. But what I was particularly mindful of, really calling attention to my listeners, to our listeners, is the fact that the time and the place are so central. I mean, the place being here in the Bay Area, of course, and you pretty much go through the whole element. I mean, we're talking about Watergate, we're talking about the zebra killings, we're talking about so many things that the prison movement that's centered here in the Bay Area at that time, even movies like Dirty Harry and TV shows like The Streets of San Francisco, but also the eerie. You make this cutoff that Susan Sontag always used to say, be careful of. The 60s were one thing, the 70s are another thing. This is a story, as you see it, of the 70s.
Very much so. You know, I was alive in the 70s, but I was a kid. So I don't really have a lot of firsthand memory of this period. And I, in my naivete, kind of assumed that the 60s was the time of great tumult in this country, and the 70s, things sort of chilled out. I could not have been more wrong, and I could not have been especially more wrong about what was going on here in the Bay Area. As you pointed out, you know, the incredible crime, the serial killers, the zebra killer, the Zodiac killer, but in particular the counterculture, which began with such earnestness and idealism, where you had the Summer of Love in 1967, you had the free speech movement in 1965. By the early 70s, things had really curdled. And the people who were still involved, especially in Berkeley, were really more embittered than they were idealistic. And the SLA, which was really the Symbionese Liberation Army, was a tiny group. You know, Donald DeFries, who called himself General Field Marshal Sinque, he called it an army. There were at most a dozen people involved. And they were, for one thing, they were all white except for DeFries, and they were all people who came from middle-class families who found themselves so angry and so bitter about what was going on in the country that they turned to violence. But they weren't alone in turning to violence. They, you know, the statistic that really amazes me about this period is that in the early and mid-1970s, there were 1,000 political bombings a year in the United States. Think about what that would be like today.
That's extraordinary to just assimilate that number. It's also extraordinary to assimilate the recognition that this was a ragtag bunch led by Donald DeFries, who was not even a very good criminal, it turns out, but a lot of things centered around Vacaville and around the prison. And also George Jackson. I mean, Blood My Eye, you say, was kind of the SLA Bible, the book by George Jackson. And then you get into the ideology such as it is. I mean, it was kind of an improvisational, mainly guerrilla performance theater that they were doing. But they were influenced by, for example, Regis Debray. They were influenced, who was a writer who talked about different cultural events following other cultural events when you stirred things up and created violence. And they were drawn into the prison movement in many respects, but kind of making it up as they went along.
They did. To the extent they had any plan at all, it was to be the American counterpart to the violent radical revolutionaries around the world, the Tupamaros in Uruguay, the Red Brigades in Italy, the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. They saw themselves as the American counterpart. They were fortunately less competent than those groups, so they killed fewer people, although they did kill two people.
Well, they killed Marcus Foster to start out with, and I wanted to focus on that because he was the superintendent of schools in Oakland, and he was much beloved, it turned out, and they realized the way he was mourned that it wasn't exactly something to rally the people like they had dreamed or like Sin Q had fantasized.
I mean, it was such a deeply sinister and insane act to kill Marcus Foster. It wound up alienating the SLA even from the radical groups that were there, the Weather Underground, the Black Panthers. They did not join with the SLA. Paradoxically, though, it was one reason why they were so hard to catch, the SLA, because they had no ties to anyone else. They were on their own for so long. But after they killed Marcus Foster, the SLA had an infusion of three people.
And forgive me, wounded Robert Blackburn.
And wounded Robert Blackburn, absolutely, who fortunately is still very much alive today. They had an infusion of talent from, of all places, the Indiana University Theater Program, Bill and Emily Harris and Angela Atwood came west, and they said, you know, this murder thing is not really working out so well for us. Let's try a theatrical kidnapping. And this was the time of guerrilla theater. This was the time where they thought you could use theater for political ends. And that's where the idea for the kidnapping came from, because they were dialing back slightly their insanity from the assassination of Marcus Foster.
Was Bill Harris kind of coming across the name and realizing that Patty Hearst was in Berkeley and all of that? I mean, just kind of chance serendipity, I suppose you could call it in many ways. But I was struck by when they took her and they took her out, you know, of her home. Stephen Weed said, take anything, and they took her. they put her in the trunk of the car and they drove off and so forth. And she must have been terrified. I mean, it's horrible to even consider this, and coerced. But here's Sin Q yelling rather nasty things at her, and here's Bill Harris holding her hand.
Right, and I think that's in the car, taking them from the kidnapping in Berkeley to the safe house that they were using in Daly City. And I thought of that as sort of an interesting metaphor for her treatment during the entire time that she was in custody, that there was this push and pull. There was this good cop, bad cop. And thus, it is not entirely surprising that she was psychologically manipulated and changed by how she was treated.
Well, we're talking to Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker and CNN legal analyst. His book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. Other books include The Run of His Life about the O.J. Simpson trial. And, of course, he's one of our leading experts on the Supreme Court. And you get into this sense of the coercion and the trauma and all the rest of it, and then the media playing up the Stockholm Syndrome. And to some extent, you've really done your homework here and are one of our finest analysts, but rather cynical about that notion of putting the label, it seems to me, of Stockholm Syndrome on it. And yet, do we really know or not know? I mean, is it incontrovertible that there is or isn't a Stockholm Syndrome?
Well, see this is why I am pleased to say I think the book has touched a responsive chord, and also because why the interest in this story remains high is because it's a mystery. You know, what did she really do? Did she really become an SLA person, or was she coerced? That's the mystery at the heart of my book. Stockholm Syndrome and brainwashing, which are the terms most associated with this case, are journalistic terms. They are not medical terms. And the bank robbery in Sweden that gave rise to the term Stockholm Syndrome took place in November of 1973, just a couple of months before the kidnapping, and it had not really made much of an impression yet in the United States. So that was not discussed a lot at the time in terms of why she behaved the way she did. It was only later. Brainwashing was at the center of her case, because the term brainwashing was invented during the Korean War, and F. Lee Bailey, her lawyer, was a Korean War veteran, and he had there were these North Korean veteran these pilots, American pilots, who were shot down in North Korea, who wound up confessing to things that they clearly had not done as a result of really coercive interrogation, very intentional by the North Koreans. The SLA was not nearly organized or talented enough to do that kind of intentional, you know, intellectual transformation.
You use the word rational. It's like, in other words, it's a chameleon-like kind of thing. She becomes a convert because she wants to win their goodwill. She's identifying with them more because she likes them and the ones that are nice to her and so forth, and she takes up their cause.
Exactly. I find it is better to focus on what she did and what the influences on her rather than these buzzwords. And I believe that Patty Hearst reacted rationally to her circumstances throughout this whole ordeal. When she was captured, she started to become one with her captors. When she's arrested and facing a great deal of jail time, she says, "The hell with this. I'm going to go be back, going to be a Hearst again."
She's a pragmatic soul in many ways, and
exactly,
a resilient one. I know how you see it, and yet, you know, there are many. What does she say? I mean, she wrote a book about this.
She disagrees with me. Yeah. She says, "Look, I was in fear for my life from day one, and I just did what I did because I was in fear for my life. I was never converted to the SLA cause. I was desperately afraid every moment of being killed. And, you know, very much the heart of the book is looking at her behavior from February of 74 to September of 75 when she was arrested and seeing what were her actions voluntary. And what was especially interesting to me as someone who really didn't know much about the case when I started researching it, the extraordinary number of crimes she committed, not just the famous bank robbery for which she was convicted of the Hibernia Bank in Sunset, but two other bank robberies in Sacramento, one where a woman was killed. She set off bombs underneath cars. She tried to set off bombs. Fortunately, they fizzled beneath police cars here in San Francisco. And in perhaps the most dramatic illustration of all is when she shot up a street in Los Angeles to try to free her comrades.
They were shoplifting. They were being chased. And in fact, I mentioned David Weir and Howard Cohen's account of this. It was pretty clear. There were many times she could have escaped. That
many times.
An example of it. But the reality is that she didn't. And there's that major picture that you focus on of her standing with the carbine or the machine gun, you mm-hmm. know, under the SLA flag, dressed in her beret and everything, costume. She's Tanya then.
Well, you know, I spend a lot of time on that photograph about the circumstances of how it came to be taken by Ms. Moon Soltysik. But I say in the book, and I don't mean this facetiously, that it is like the Mona Lisa of the 1970s. Because if you look at the expression on Patty Hearst's face in that famous photograph, it's inscrutable. You can't tell if she is terrified, if she is proud, if she is happy, if she's sad. It is a Mona Lisa-like expression. And I think, again, it serves as a wonderful metaphor for the mystery at the heart of this case.
But she was, of course, and there's no denying the fact, she was not only taken by force and traumatized almost unquestioned, but raped.
That is not at all settled by any means. You know, the SLA confessed to virtually everything in terms of setting off bombs, in terms of robbing banks, in terms of kidnapping Patty Hearst. The one thing that they all insisted was that Patty Hearst was never abused, never raped, and the prosecutors in the bank in the bank robbery case asserted that she was never raped. I take a somewhat agnostic position on that. It's a very difficult question. I have real doubts about whether Sin Q ever had sex with her at all. It does seem clear that
Willie Wolfe did. Though.
Willie Wolfe did, but it is also true, it is also apparent that she fell in love with Willie
Wolfe.
Yeah,
she talks, I remember Cujo, and you know, in the tape she sounded like he was endearing to her.
And the critical piece of evidence at her trial was the charm that she was carrying a year and a half after Willie Wolfe's death that he gave her, that the prosecution argued showed that she wouldn't have carried this charm from him if she had no feelings for him. And that made a big impression on the jury.
She also supposedly had feelings for Stephen Soliah, though?
Well, that, it's undisputed. She was living with Stephen Soliah. Even Patty acknowledges in her book that they were having a consensual relationship.
Well, many of you remember the Patty Hearst case. Many of you youngins don't remember it or know anything about it. It's an opportunity for you to learn more, but we do invite your calls. Questions or comments are welcome. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Your memories welcome, your thoughts and questions and comments as well. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker, CNN legal analyst, his book, American Heiress. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to Jeffrey Toobin, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and also a legal analyst for CNN, and has a new book, American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. Other books include The Run of His Life about the O.J. Simpson trial, and the memories are coming in, as I expected they would be. Enrique writes, "Hello all. I worked for Mosler Safe when this was going on. I saw the bank camera films come out of the dark room and handed to the FBI. I also remember the food giveaway in East Oakland. Interesting times." That's an understatement. And again, younger listeners of that younger demographic may not know about this, but What happened was the SLA, liking, as Jeff Toobin was saying, to do things of a performance nature, the influence of Indiana again, decided that they would have a food giveaway. And Randolph Hearst, here locally of San Mateo, acceded to their demands.
He put up a total of about $4 million, and they actually did give away a great deal of food. They rented a warehouse down in China Basin, right near where the Giants play now, and they actually gave away a great deal of food. It didn't go smoothly, to say the least. There were riots in certain circumstances.
It was chaos.
But just in keeping with the craziness of San Francisco at the time, the volunteer bookkeeper for the food giveaway was a proper young woman, not so young, middle-aged woman named Sarah Jane Moore, who the week that Patty Hearst was arrested in September of 1975 nearly assassinated Gerald Ford as he was coming out of the St. Francis Hotel in Union Square. I mean, just the connections to crazy San Francisco stories are legion.
I love some of the connections you make here. I mean, Errol Morris gets in the picture, and Judge Ito of the O.J. trial gets in the picture.
I've been teased
listeners with that and so forth. And there's been a lot of raves about the book. Wonder what you say, though. I happened to read a review in The Guardian, and it was a very positive review, I should add. But they said, you know, you were making too light of Shulamith Firestone on the one hand, who was one of the feminist icons of the time, and said that Angela Atwood was empty-headed. She was one of the members of the SLA, and the person who was writing the review said she was not empty-headed.
Yes, she was. the SLA wrote these long communiques that were in a sort of pigeon Marxism, written in the style of the extreme radical left.
Can I quote the most famous one?
Please.
Which, death to the fascist insect that preys upon the people. That preys upon
the life of the people. The life of the
me,
people.
Yeah.
That was how they closed all their communiques, both written and broadcast. And I think that's indicative of the level of thought and dialogue. You know, death to the fascist instinct. What the hell does that mean? The one thing you can say for them is that they did have this sort of antic spirit that attracted at least some people. And, you know, the idea that you kidnap this woman and instead of asking for money for yourself, you ask for money to feed the poor of Northern California, I mean, that was certainly a twist on the usual kidnapping story, and it was part of what attracted Patricia to join in with them.
Now, you've come here to the Bay Area. I know you love the Bay Area.
I do.
And you get to see all these places that you write about and go to them. In fact, you went to Hibernia Bank.
I've been to all these places. I wanted to see what they were like 40 years later. I mean, some of these places have been leveled and replaced by new things. And I wondered if that was true for the Hibernia Bank in Sunset. Well, so I go to Sunset. And if you drive along Noriega, the bank from the outside looks exactly the same as in all the photographs, but it is no longer a bank. It's a community health center. So I walked in the bank, and there are cubicles, but again, the outlines of the bank are still there. And I go up to someone, I say, like, who's in charge here? And they point to this woman. And Sunset, as I suspect many people know, it's very much an Asian neighborhood now. It was Irish, Catholic, Italian in the 70s. Everyone I saw in the community health center was Asian. So I meet the medical director, and she's a young Asian woman. And I say to her, do you know anything about the history of this building? And she looks at me and she smiles. She goes, oh, this is a very famous building. So she knew that this was the site of the first SLA bank robbery. But San Francisco is really a important character in my book. But it's also a very different San Francisco from the one where we see today.
But as you said, so is Berkeley, so is Walnut or Concord, so is Daly City, I mean, and San Mateo. I mean, it really is a Bay Area story. I got to mention something. Unfortunately, former, just got word, Deputy Oakland Superintendent Robert Blackburn actually died this month at his Oakland home
from complications
stemming from a chronic heart condition.
Certainly apologize for saying that. When I was working on the book, he was very much alive, and he was really heroic in he was shot very seriously when Marcus Foster was killed and went on to have a continuing career in education. So I apologize for saying that, and I apologize for not knowing.
But I got to say, you know, again, the details in your book just about cyanide bullets, which were used in that killing of Marcus Foster. Apparently, you learn if you read Jeff Toobin's book that only 10% of the population can smell cyanide.
It smells sort of like almonds, another fact that I didn't know. And you know, again, this was part of the theatrical nature of the SLA. In fact, if you put cyanide on bullets, it doesn't make them any more deadly. But if you have cyanide tip bullets, you seem more badass than you are otherwise. And that was really the goal.
A listener named Billy says, has Patty commented on your book at all? And did you try to have any contact with her at any time during the writing or completion?
Yes, I tried very hard to talk to Patty.
Unsuccessfully.
Yeah. She did not talk to me. In fact, I can quote our one conversation in its entirety. You know, I had written, I had emailed, I had worked through intermediaries, but, you know, I was getting pretty far along in my research. So I said, what the hell, I'll call. I had a phone number for her. And so I called and she answered. I said, hi, Patricia, this is Jeff Toobin. And she said, oh, God, click. So that's we didn't have a long conversation, as you can see. Look, she's in her early 60s. She's got two kids. She's got two grandchildren. She's a widow. As many people may remember, she married her bodyguard, Bernie Shaw.
She's a horse lady.
No, she's a dog.
I mean, a dog
person,
lady.
A dog.
Me, yes,
yeah, she raises Shih Tzus. And one of her dogs just won the best toy competition at the Westminster Kennel Club, which is like the big national dog show. And, you know, she has become, I mean, one of the amazing aspects of this story to me is that she's become the woman she was destined to be.
And you do make an argument here implicitly. She also was destined to be a John Waters movie star for at least a brief period of time. But you make the argument here that well, first of all, let's just go back historically. She was sentenced to 7 years. She served 22 months. And then she had her sentence commuted by President Bill Clinton. And
commuted
by President Carter.
Carter, right.
And then she was given essentially a pardon by President Clinton. And there's a fairly strong argument in your book that this is how it works for those who are privileged, for those essentially who have as opposed to the have not, or they have some.
It is that, to me, is one of the most extraordinary parts of the story, is that not only did much of the Bay Area, Democrats and Republicans, rally to ask Jimmy Carter to commute her sentence, but 20 years later, she was able to mobilize much of the same coalition to get her a pardon. She is the only person in modern American history to receive a commutation from one president and a pardon from another. And when you look at the number of crimes she committed, the bank robbery for which she was convicted, the two other bank robberies, shooting up the street in L.A., the attempted bombings, and compare that to how many people rot in prison in this country for lesser offenses, it is a pretty astonishing fact to me that she got a commutation and a pardon. And it's a real lesson on the value of wealth and privilege in the United States.
One more astonishing fact. I think it's still on record that the shootout in Los Angeles in which the SLA were essentially killed, almost all of them, was the biggest police shootout in U.S. history. I
Absolutely.
Think that's still the
yes.
case.
Yes, yeah. This was after the bank robbery of Hibernia. They fled to Los Angeles, and six of the nine were killed in this extraordinary shootout.
It was just the Harrises and
Bill and Emily Harris and Patricia, who just by coincidence happened not to be home at the time.
Let's go to your calls, and we begin with Janet. Good morning.
Good morning. I have to say, we're about the same age. Patty Hearst and I are about the same age. I was in college here in Northern California, and I was glued to KSAN, KSAN radio. They would play the telephone recordings of her, and her voice was this frightening monotone. I'm convinced she was brainwashed or something was going on. And of course, we were the same age, and the whole thing was so confusing to me. Like, how could this happen? What's going on with her? Why is she sticking around with these guys? And I was glued to that radio for months when she was calling in. And well, I just wanted to make the call.
Well, if I could just make one point. I mean, I've heard from a lot of people like this. And Patty's voice is very distinctive. And it is that kind of breathy monotone. It's actually somewhat similar to
Catherine's,
her mother, but Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Oh. You know, the sort of rich girl's voice, rich girl's diction, kind of a little aloof, kind of a little bored. And I think it is very much part of the story, the voice that so many people found so hypnotizing. And you know, as we discussed at the beginning, though it never really varied that much, it became much more aggressive and confident as she joined with the SLA.
And I thank you for that call. Actually, speaking about radio and gluing to the radio, you know, there was a station here in San Francisco that just covered O.J. 24 hours for it was on the air for quite a while.
It was true in L.A. in L.A. as well.
We go to Jim next. Jim, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Mr. Tobin, did your research discover what then-Governor Ronald Reagan remarked for anyone who goes to pick up the ransom food?
This is a great Ronald Reagan moment. I mean, great in the sense of revealing that, you know, after the Hearsts agreed to feed the poor of California and put up all this money and started to distribute it, Ronald Reagan was at a function in Washington, D.C., and they asked him about it, and he said, I hope there's an outbreak of botulism, which was indicative of his sort of tough on crime attitude that he thought the Hearsts were giving in to this demand, and he wanted no part of it. When you think about what botulism actually does to people, and these were just poor people who wanted something to eat, it's a really pretty ugly remark when you think about it, but it was, again, indicative of a lot of the big splits that were going on in this country at that
time. Well, there was a lot of political action in those days at Berkeley, and you remember Reagan also said, let there be a bloodletting. If there has to be a bloodletting, so be it, you know.
And Catherine Hearst was on the Board of Regents that was nominally in charge of the University of California, all its campuses, and she was a big supporter of Ronald Reagan's hard line.
More of your calls, and I'll get to your comments in a moment. Let me get a caller on here from Vallejo. Lynn, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. Now, I think I made this up in my own brain, but perhaps Jeffrey can clear it up. I seem to remember that Bill and Emily Harris were released from prison, and I'd like to know where the hell they are.
They were certainly released from prison. They actually did two stints in prison. They did about 6 years for the kidnapping. And then many years later, they were prosecuted along with Kathy Solia, who later surfaced as Sarah Jane Olson in St. Paul, Minnesota, for the bank robbery in Sacramento that led to the death of Myrna Opsahl, and they did another 6 or 7 years. But they have spent, you know, a great deal of time out. They got divorced. Bill Harris went to work here in San Francisco as a private investigator, of all things, and from all that I've been able to hear, was a very good one. Emily Harris moved to Los Angeles, where she has lived with another woman for a very long time, and she learned computers in prison and became a computer consultant and lives in lives outside Los Angeles. Unlike Bill, who has talked about this experience a lot, including to me, Emily Harris has not ever discussed this whole story publicly. She also has changed her name so that if you look for Emily Harris, you won't find it. And I know her new name, but I'll respect her privacy and not disclose it. But they have spent, you know, they both did roughly 12 years in prison. But since it's been 40 years since these incidents, they've spent most of their time out.
Now, I mentioned before the article that was done by Howard Cohen and our own David Weir, and he goes into a lot of they go into a lot of analysis about a figure named Jack Scott, who appears later on. He was an athletic director and so forth, and the SLA was just looking for a place, a roof over their head, what was left of the SLA, the Harrises, basically. And he came along and said, give up your weapons, and that was basically that. Where is he now? What's happening?
Jack Scott died. Jack Scott died of cancer at a unfortunately young age. But he also, I think, is a wonderfully emblematic figure of this period because, you know, at one level he was an activist and someone who really wanted to, you know, affect political change. And he was very prescient in talking about athletes' rights, talking about you know, drug use and loss of scholarships. He became very close friends with Bill Walton, the great basketball player. He, but also, you know, he sort of he had an angle, and he wanted to try to get the SLA to write a book that he could sell, and you know, for you know, make a great deal of money. And so he took Bill and Emily and Patricia across the country to Pennsylvania, and set them up in a farmhouse to try to write a book. You perhaps will not be surprised to learn the book writing didn't go so smoothly, and that whole relationship fell apart, and that's when they came back west and wound up robbing more banks. But, I mean, Jack Scott was an admirable, interesting person, but he also reflected the, you know, the countervailing pressures that people were under at that period.
Here's Anne, who says, I'm about two-thirds through Tubin's book, and I keep thinking about the parallels between the radicalized leftist terrorists of the 1970s and the homegrown U.S. terrorists today. Tubin describes radicals who had not read much Marx or Engels, etc., but were fighting what they perceived as their oppressors. Doesn't it seem like the recent jihadist terrorist acts in the United States are by people who similarly frame protests within a larger movement but are uninformed about Islam and the history of social revolutions?
I think that's a very apt observation. You know, we are spending a lot of time now thinking about what makes some kid in Brussels or Paris or Minneapolis decide to join ISIS. Or, and now we have this guy in New Jersey whose family ran a chicken stand who set off these two bombs, apparently, he's accused, in Lower Manhattan.
And in New Jersey, and left a backpack with explosives in another part of New Jersey.
Right.
You know, if he's indeed a loner.
Exactly. And what, you know, the question that we keep asking is, what turns someone this way? And the answer is, we don't know. And there is no one pattern. Now, if you look at the SLA, they were mostly women. And the women were almost all high school cheerleaders. Now, does being a high school cheerleader turn you into a terrorist? Obviously not. And I think the incredibly varied middle class conventional backgrounds of these SLA people illustrate just how hard it is to identify what makes people turn this way, because lots of people who have these same influences, it never even occurs to them to become terrorists.
Here's Nancy, who writes, I was in San Francisco at the time. People were very contemptuous of the FBI's failures in this case. I lived near Buena Vista Park, where we were sure that there was an FBI stakeout looking for Patty Hearst. A really obvious panel van was parked in the neighborhood for several days. You know, one of the things that was most alarming was when Nancy Ling Perry tried to burn down a house that they were in the East Bay here. There was still a lot of evidence, and it became, as you write about it, a carnival. I mean, people were taking all these souvenirs and going in there. But there was a list of people who might be kidnapped victims by them, including Patty Hearst. No follow-up. None.
None of them were warned. The incompetence of the FBI investigation is definitely one of the themes of my book. But again, I think that didn't come out of nowhere. J. Edgar Hoover had just died in 1972. It was very much his FBI. And what it meant to be an FBI agent in 1974-75 when they were looking for Patty Hearst was to be a crew-cut white guy with big black Cordovan shoes. And these were the people who were supposedly going to infiltrate the counterculture. Well, not surprisingly, it didn't go so well. And they were completely at sea in trying to penetrate these communities. And that's why it took a year and a half to find them, even though they were sending communiques, even though they had fingerprints, even though they had the names of all these people, they still couldn't find them.
Let me read another comment from Sean. He writes, I was a young child growing up in San Francisco in the 70s and remember the period with great vividness. It was terrifying. A neighbor's VW van was blowing up in front of our house in Laurel Heights, right behind the Children's Hospital, and the smell of whatever chemicals they used in that bombing lingered for years. I remember fires up and down the street. In the spring of 74, our home was suddenly surrounded by SFPD, acting on a tip that Ms. Hearst and company were hiding in the basement of our building. I remember being questioned by a very intense detective, cameras all around the periphery, along with the Zebra and Zodiac killings. It was a very troubling period to be a child.
You know, I completely get that. And this is what I learned in writing American Heiress. You know, I started visiting San Francisco as an adult when it was this expensive, high-tech, glamorous, beautiful city. And I had to learn just how dangerous things were in the 1970s. You mentioned briefly Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry. And the producers of Dirty Harry wanted to put him in the most dangerous, scary city in America to prove how tough he was. So people forget that Dirty Harry was a San Francisco detective. And because that's what the reputation of this city was in the 1970s, as the worst city in
America. And when he said, make my day, he was saying it to some pretty bad characters who were identified with San Francisco.
Absolutely.
Although San Francisco is a big, you know, you talk about the counterculture, there's a lot of bohemianism and love and flowers and all of that as well.
But by the 70s, it was a lot of drugs and crime,
yeah,
too.
I mean, yeah. Manson and, yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking again with Jeffrey Toobin, who is staff writer with The New Yorker and CNN legal analyst, and who has a book out called American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, we urge you to go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to another caller, and let's hear from a caller in Berkeley. Joe, you're on. Morning.
Hey, yeah, first of all, I can't wait to read your book. Secondly, I was living on Spruce Street in Berkeley. I was a graduate student right at the corner of Rose, and that was where they switched her from one car to another. And I remember that morning cops knocking on my door asking if I'd seen anything that night. I think you bring this up really well. I don't think there's been any crime that matches that as far as the crime of the century. Just to live through that day after day, it was amazing. First of all, I read her book many years ago, and I tend to disagree with your premise. Of course she committed those acts, and of course it seems like she was doing their bidding and that she believed in their cause. But isn't the very premise of brainwashing of the Stockholm syndrome that you start to believe in that just as a means of self-preservation? My vague recollection is that she was told they would kill her family if she didn't cooperate, that once she saw her face on the FBI most wanted list, yeah, they convinced her that the FBI was looking for her and that they were going to kill her. And then, of course, the shootout. You know, I'm sure she must have thought, had I been there, I was going to be killed too.
Well, so, I think...
Oh, she was calling the police pigs at
right,
that time.
Yeah, and you have put your finger on the central issue in the book and the central controversy that lingers to this day about Patty's behavior, and it is certainly, you know, something I write about at length. At some point, there is, I think, free will. And when you look at the number of times she had the opportunity to escape, when you look at the fact that she and Steve Solia were hiking in Pacifica and they get stranded on a cliffside and they have to summon the state police for help, and the state police puts ropes about them and brings them upstairs, you know, brings them to the top of the cliff, and they give fake names so they're not identified. When she gets poison oak and she goes to San Francisco General Hospital to get treated, and she says, you know, she gives a fake name rather than says, I'm Patty Hearst. I mean, these are completely clear opportunities where she could have said, take me home. She didn't. And, you know, and when she's arrested, you know, she gives her occupation as urban guerrilla. That was true. That was her occupation.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me go next to you, Walter. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, yes. Well, I can tell you the lengths the FBI was going through to try to find the Harrises. I had gone to Indiana University for a couple years, and I was from the Bay Area. And I was living in Napa, and I got a knock on the door, and this man, I opened the door. He says, I'm from the FBI. I want to show you some pictures. So he walked in and showed me the Harrises. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, do you know him? I said, no, why would I know him? He said, well, weren't you at Indiana University last year? And I said, yeah, along with 25 or 30,000 other students. So I said, well, why did you come talk to me? He said, well, we're following every person from the Bay Area that was in Indiana last year.
What kind of shoes was the guy wearing? Do you remember?
Yeah, well, I can't believe it. He drove a pea green Ford and had a narrow black tie.
See, there you go. I mean, you know, this just the kind of people who could infiltrate the weather underground,
yeah.
Right?
Thanks for that memory, Walter. Good to hear from you. Let me hear from another caller, Richard, joining us. Richard?
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Hi.
And to the guest, good morning to you as well. Listen, I'd just like to say that, you know, if this were a woman of color that walked into the Hibernian Bank, she would still be staring at the cell walls in a penitentiary here in California. But I also believe that Patty was a willing, she was a willing captive. And I say that simply because this is a woman that, woman at that time, yeah, that was raised as a socialite in Hillsborough. And once she, I believe this to be a total lark on her part. Once she got a taste of this criminal, I say mock revolutionary behavior, I think that she bought into it. I'm not, I don't think there was anything related to the Stockholm syndrome. I believe her to be a willing captive here. So the other part is, one really quick thing I want to say is that Paul Krasner, back in that day, dedicated an entire issue of The Realist to the conspiracy of the entire SLA operation. And he contracted May Brussel, who was some kind of a journalist from Monterey, and she exposed a lot of what this was, and that she felt that they were all government dupes, and that Bill and Emily Harris were narcotics agents from Indiana. Sing Q was an LAPD SWAT informant. So they're only theories, obviously, but it's interesting to boot.
Just theory. And yeah. May Brussels, boy, I haven't heard that name in so long.
To that, I can only say, oh, please.
Yeah. But you remember there was a great line back in the day that said maybe Patty Hearst is just doing getting 3 units credit trial. not her trial, but the trials that she went through. Jeff, always good to have you on. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Jeffrey Toobin. The book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And you can continue this discussion, by the way, online, kqed.org. We get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Maxine Schoffer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Thank you again for listening. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.